It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Darrell Connor. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's Dairy Task Force recently passed new proposals aimed at shoring up the state's dairy industry. We'll talk to the director of the task force.
First, we take our weekly look at some of the top news from the nation's capital. Congress is busy this week trying to pass a bill to fund the government and avoid a partial shutdown. There's been a new appointment to fill the seat once held by John McCain in the Senate, and a bill reforming the federal criminal justice system has passed the Senate with bipartisan support.
And this week, we'd like to know what you think about criminal justice reform. Do you agree with expanding early release programs and shortening minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders, both of which are included in the bill making its way through Congress? Are there other changes you'd like to see made by lawmakers? Is criminal justice a big voting issue for you? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org.
Emily Cochran is a reporter covering Congress for the New York Times. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's get the latest. It's a moving target, this potential shutdown story. What do we know right now?
Well, this morning, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell introduced a stopgap spending bill. It would keep the government fully funded through the beginning of February. It remains to be seen if the president will sign it, but both Republicans and Democrats have indicated that's something they would get behind.
So instead of maybe having a shutdown right before Christmas, we might have a shutdown right before Valentine's Day? Are we going to have this fight again in 2 months?
Yes, I think border security is going to be an issue that will continue even with a Democratic majority in the House. Certainly the Republicans' chances of getting funding for a border wall will be slimmer with Nancy Pelosi. You know, she's currently in line to be next speaker. With her in charge, that funding is less likely to come their way. But the concern right now is just keeping the government funded.
And President Trump had said last week he'd be proud to shut down the government if he didn't get this border wall funding from Congress. It sounds like at least in the short run, the White House won't insist on this border wall funding in a continuing resolution from what we know right now.
Like a lot of things, things are pretty fluid in terms of what's coming from the White House. The president has indicated that he would be willing to walk that back. He made a tweet yesterday saying that it would not be funding for a wall, it'd be funding for artistic slats. So it does seem that he's walking that back a little bit, but I don't think the issue is going to completely disappear.
Now, Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, he's expected to bring this short-term spending bill up for a vote. Doesn't sound real enthusiastic about it. Here he is talking to reporters. This is yesterday.
If we end up going with a relatively short-term CR, we will end up, in effect, punting this year's business into next year. I think it's not a very desirable outcome. From anybody's point of view, I would think it'd be the least desirable outcome for the incoming speaker's point of view.
CR there, continuing resolution. Maybe nobody wants it, but Emily, this is the way we keep funding the government, right? These short-term stopgap measures.
Yes, and certainly both Republicans and Democrats today have expressed frustration that a stopgap spending bill seems to be the only way to keep the government fully funded. The Democrats would like to hit the ground running in January with their new agenda. Instead, they're going to be dealing with this again if the CR passes. And both sides have spent a lot of time negotiating these seven remaining bills, and if there's just a stopgap spending bill, a CR, that work gets tabled. And they would really like to see something come of that. But again, a CR seems to be the most likely outcome at this point.
It's our weekly roundup of national politics. Emily Cochran is with us, congressional reporter for the New York Times. Let's go to our callers. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if Emily would have some insight about why legislators put so many things into each bill instead of just having one issue, one bill, vote on it, then move on to another one, instead of having like hundreds of pages per bill and these just being so complicated.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. Emily, yeah, this is a big budget bill, and as we'll get into, people are trying to get other things attached to it. Why is there so much content packed into each vote?
Well, I think part of it is because there are, at this moment, it's seven individual bills that would fund a number of federal agencies. And I think that's why you're seeing so many things getting pulled into it, because it covers so much of what these departments do.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. Now, another thing that is apparently getting attached maybe to this funding bill, do I have this right? Lawmakers are trying to get a variety of bills. One of those is the Israel Anti-Boycott Act. What is that?
So it's unclear if that's going to make it through. Like many of the things lawmakers are raising, they would like to see it get through before the end of the year, but Richard Shelby, who is the Senate Appropriations Chairman, has said that the president has indicated that a clean CRA bill without any additional amendments is the most likely thing for him to sign. This particular bill, it's been around for a few months. It would modify an already existing law to say that if a company refused to do business with Israel because of a contract with a foreign country, that would not be allowed. It does not prohibit the company from individually saying, I don't want to do business, but it would not allow that if it was in conjunction with a foreign country or organization.
And critics of this bill are worried, they say, about, among other things, about the First Amendment implications here. There's a lawsuit. You've been writing about this against a similar Texas law. So there is some controversy surrounding this?
Yes. This issue is very personal for a lot of people, and it's been around for quite some time. There's a broader effort right now to suppress support for these efforts to boycott or divest investments from Israel. And for example, for the ACLU, they don't have a specific position on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but they see anything that creates a penalty for a First Amendment-related activity, they consider that to be an infringement of the First Amendment. So that's where some of this comes from.
Now let's turn into an issue that a lot of people in the Senate agreed on, this criminal justice reform bill. And this has got support from some groups on the left, some groups on the right, the ACLU, you just mentioned, they're on board with this. What are some of the things this bill that's now passed the Senate, we need action in the House still, what are some of the things this would change?
So some of the things, as my colleagues have reported, it would shorten mandatory minimum sentences for some nonviolent drug offenses. It would give judges greater liberty to use what are called safety valves to go around mandatory minimums. And it would also clarify some of the mechanisms in the law. It's a way to kind of alleviate the number of the federal prison population and create a more fair criminal justice system in the eyes of many lawmakers, and people have lobbied for this.
And as a congressional reporter, is this unusual on a potentially controversial issue to get as much bipartisan support as this thing did?
I think for many of the reporters who have religiously covered this this issue, this was an unlikely group of both liberals and conservatives that have gotten together behind this bill, and especially considering some of the partisan rancor that we've seen over the past few months, it was a huge achievement.
And this is something that would only affect federal criminal justice. That's about 12% of people I checked in prison in the United States. Most people are in the state. That said, looking ahead, the Senate has passed this. Is it expected to pass in the House and then get signed by President Trump?
Yes. As we've reported, that House leaders have pledged to pass it, and President Trump has said he would sign it. It's unclear when those would happen, but it's expected.
We're talking to Emily Cochran, congressional reporter for the New York Times, and we're looking at some of the top news in national politics.
Still time for you to weigh in on a criminal justice reform bill making its way through Congress with bipartisan support. Do you support things like reducing minimum sentences for some drug offenders and expanding early release programs? What other changes would you like to see in the criminal justice system? Is this an issue that sways your vote? And if you have questions about what Congress is up to before the end of the year, let us know. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Emily Cochran from the New York Times, looking at the latest from Congress and national politics before the current congressional session wraps up. We invited your calls on criminal justice reform, a big bill just passed the U.S. Senate. Let's go to a caller now. Kurt is with us in Elkhorn. Kurt, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, I'll tell you what. When you look outside our borders, Iceland, Greenland, Europe, Germany. There are countries out there that have a maximum penalty or maximum years in jail of only 21 because their repeat rate is certainly almost zero. Now, there's something we're doing wrong in this country. I think we're making a lot of people rich because you think about it. Somebody spends 60 years in jail. Do you really think that they're going to be any kind of a benefit to the society after they get out?
Kurt, thanks a lot for the call. So, Emily, outside the specifics of what other countries might be doing, is there a sense in Congress and from the people who have been calling for this kind of reform that whatever we're doing, something's wrong and something needs to change?
I think there's definitely a feeling that something does need to change with the criminal justice system, and this is seen as a first step. It's colloquially known as the First Step Act. And, for example, Senator Cory Booker, who's from New Jersey, when he came off the Senate floor last night after the vote, he said he saw this as a first step in a much longer process, but everyone is very, at least in the halls of Congress, and very excited that this bipartisan legislation had made it through and will now go to the House. And then after that, it's expected to hit the president's desk.
Thanks for that call. We also heard from Russell in Beaver Dam, who says, take marijuana off of Schedule 1 drug classification. I'm pretty sure this new bill doesn't do that, but there are lighter sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. That was a big piece of this, right?
Yes.
All right. Our listeners can keep commenting on this. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I want to look at some, I guess, personnel changes, Emily, in the U.S. Senate. Now we had John Kyle, former U.S. Senator. He's been serving again as senator in the late John McCain's seat from Arizona. After Senator McCain passed away. Now he's resigning, John Kyle, at the end of the year. Arizona's governor is appointing Republican Martha McSally, who just lost a Senate race in Arizona. Can you talk about that story a little bit?
Well, Martha McSally, as you said, did lose her original Senate race, but she was just appointed to fill John McCain's seat. She's someone that the president personally campaign for. It's an unusual situation, I think, to have the two candidates suddenly in the Senate together. But President Trump personally campaigned for her, as I said, and also, as my colleagues reported, Mitch McConnell advocated for her, and the governor, in making his decision, took into account that she already has a fundraising base, and she does have statewide name recognition that comes from running for Senate.
Now, if she had won the race for Senate, she'd be in there for 6 years, as I understand it, because this is a fill-in gig. She'll have to run for re-election in just 2 years. Do I have that right?
I believe so.
Yeah, so she will have the advantage of running as an incumbent in Arizona. Now, there's another change. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander, he's going to finish out his term, but he's not going to be running for re-election in the state of Tennessee in 2020. Can you talk about his role on the Senate?
He's been a big part of the Senate. He has respect from both sides of the aisle, both in the aftermath of his announcement. Both Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, the two party leaders in the Senate, had very complimentary things to say about him and his contribution. He said that the reason why he wanted to step down was because he wanted to leave the Senate at, quote, the top of his game. Bob Corker, his colleague from Tennessee, also is retiring this year, so Tennessee will see some changes in the next few years in terms of their Senate representation.
So Republicans won't have an incumbent running for election in that Senate seat in Tennessee in 2020. Sounds like a lot of people I'm reading say Democrats don't get your hopes up. This is probably not a state Democrats are going to win unless something weird is happening. Is that kind of the conventional wisdom that you're seeing out there?
That is a thought, my colleagues have reported at this point, but as we've seen in a number of other races, that could change depending on what candidates come forward for either party.
We're talking to Emily Cochran from the New York Times, looking at some of the top stories this week in national politics. Let's take a look at the sentencing now, I guess non-sentencing, actually, of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Fairly complicated, long-running story. What do we know about why this delay is happening?
It was certainly an unusual hearing that we had earlier this week. The judge gave Mr. Flynn the option of postponing his sentencing, so he had additional time to prove the importance of his cooperation with federal prosecutors, and that was something that he took up. So a decision will be delayed until at least March.
Now, looking ahead to 2019, as you mentioned earlier, Democrats will be in charge of the House. Are you expecting to see a lot of House-led, Democratic-led investigations into stories related to not just Michael Flynn, but everything involved in this Russia probe?
I think it remains to be seen what exactly the Democrats choose to pursue with their oversight power. They have named the desire to protect the special counsel as something that they're interested in, as well as maybe looking into the president's tax returns and some other things. They're also focused on pursuing healthcare legislation, climate change, and infrastructure plans. So I think it'll be one of many things that we see come January.
And finally, as we wrap up, it's likely that Nancy Pelosi will be the next House Speaker. Paul Ryan, the current House Speaker, he's on his way out, and he gave a farewell address, kind of the end of an era. He's been a long-running Wisconsin lawmaker and key member of the Republican caucus. Any thoughts on his departure?
It's hard to say at this point what anyone's legacy is going to be. Certainly, he's been around for quite some time, and he did struggle to unite his party, especially in the era of President Trump, but he will be missed by several Republicans for his work on the Hill.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Emily Cochran is a reporter covering Congress for New York Times. She was with us for an update on what's happening in national politics. Now it's time for an edition of Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about breaking up with technology.
I bet some of you listening are a little addicted to your phones. Keeping up with texts, social media, news updates, and cat videos, some days you might spend more time with your phone than the actual living, breathing people in your lives. Madison comedian Esteban Tuma just got out of an unhealthy relationship with his phone, and he offers this cautionary tale.
I should have seen it coming. Right after my phone broke up with me, I recalled all the signs I had missed. It had been acting pretty distant lately. It felt like every notification came with a sigh, every calendar input a bit testy, every response to the on button a little off. I mean, I guess I had been distant too, keeping it in my pocket while having dinner or reading a book in the bathroom, a book, and always with the perfect excuse. Zero photos of the Steely Dan tribute concert. I had low battery. No emojis in a 2-hour span. I was driving. I guess I could have at least checked it for notifications during the boring stretches of highway, but no, I kept it in my back pocket like some cheap leather wallet. Have things really changed that much since we first met at the Verizon store months ago? I was there looking for anything, an LG, hell, even a Samsung, something casual I could use for a couple of months. Nothing too serious, I just wanted to have some fun. But as I browsed, Dan, the clerk, pointed it out from across the store. That one would be perfect for you, he said. I felt like a boy watching my prom date descend the stairs. My heart was racing. I had it unpackaged before we even got to the car. We spent an hour just getting to know each other right there in the mall parking lot, our first date. But now it wouldn't even respond to my pleas. At least tell me why. Burn my pocket, delete my photos, anything but the silent mode treatment. At least give me the, it's not you, it's my operating system line. I laid awake in bed that night thinking, where had our intimacy gone? Like when I changed the pin lock to thumb recognition. The phone gently shook after those 3 seconds of contact, opening its home screen to me as I slowly explore the pages of the app's menu, the screen gradually warming as I slid down the notifications panel. I dimmed the brightness and... This is no ordinary love. I couldn't sleep at all. The next morning, I grabbed some coffee and tried to stay positive. I can still fix things, I said. I started by asking my so-called buddies on the tech support forum. Have you tried a hard reset? XXCrushBytesXX asked. A hard reset? Was he crazy? And erase everything with Build Together? No. I logged out without even saying goodbye. I needed professional advice and there was only one place where I could get it. Back at the Verizon store, Dan remembered us right away. Let me see what I can do, he said kindly. After several minutes that seemed like hours, Dan called me over with a sad nod. It's best if you both move on, he said, and he was right, and I knew it. Heartbroken, I asked, can I just pick up my SIM and SD cards? Dan gave me a minute. The phone waited in silence as I grabbed my things. I held the battery in my hands, feeling its heat one last time. The phone was totally dark now. Nothing but a black screen reflecting back to me what could have been. I got in my car, wiped my tears, and turned on the radio. Maybe I'd call the guys, grab a beer at that place near the Apple store. It's been a while, I wonder what Apple's been up to, I thought. Maybe I'd drop in and see what's up, maybe find something casual, something fun. You know, nothing too serious.
Esteban Tuma is a comedian in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk with the director of Wisconsin's Dairy Task Force about what changes the group wants to see to boost the dairy industry here in the state. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Coming up, a new survey shows that many Americans don't understand how state government works and who represents them. A Wisconsin politics expert makes the case that we need to know more about civics at the state and local level.
First, Wisconsin lost over 600 dairy farms so far in 2018, and the number of registered dairy herds fell more than 7%, the biggest drop since record-keeping started in 2004.
Faced with declines in the industry, the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection formed the Dairy Task Force earlier this year to develop ways to help farmers and dairy producers. Last week, the group approved two proposals aimed at strengthening loan programs for farmers and boosting agricultural research and education.
Mark Stevenson is the Director of Dairy Policy Analysis at UW-Madison and Director of the Dairy Task Force. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Happy to be here.
Let's look at the basic problems facing dairy farmers before we get into the particular recommendations. And it seems like I keep hearing long-term sustained low milk prices are really a big part of the story.
Well, that's certainly been a big part of the story right now. We're entering our fifth year of relatively low prices, and we haven't seen something like that in a very long time. We've had short and deeper plunges in price, but they haven't been this long.
And can you talk about, we gave a couple of the numbers there on declines in dairy farming in the state. Can you talk a little more, flesh that out a little for us?
Sure. We have been seeing a lot more in the way of farm attrition and consolidation. And the one thing we don't seem to be seeing yet is a contraction of milk production. So we are losing farms. They tend to be smaller farms. The farms that are remaining are still producing more milk. I think a lot of people are just at a life stage where if they aren't making money, if it's not profitable for them, it just doesn't make sense for them to continue to borrow money against their retirement equity.
Prices down, production up. Is this a story of operators saying, if I'm going to make money with low milk prices, I have to get economies of scale. I have to produce more for cheaper.
I'm sure there's a little bit of that, but really I don't think that's the motivating factor for a lot of people. Some of our farms that have been most successful over time have been the ones who had the incentive and the wherewithal to become bigger, do more of it, and that's what they've done. There are some economies of scale to be captured, but that's not the biggest reason.
That brings us to the Dairy Task Force. What were you charged with doing?
Well, we wanted to try to set the stage for our longer-term vital dairy industry. Back in the mid-1980s, we had another dairy task force that was formed, and some of the recommendations that they made were very successful in providing what we've had over the last 20 years here. We want to do the same thing for the dairy industry for the next 20 years.
Talking to Mark Stevenson with UW-Madison, director of the state's Dairy Task Force. It is still working on recommendations, but Mark, you've got a couple of recommendations that you've already made. One had to do with creating a new loan guarantee program for dairy farmers and then producers, people who produce stuff with the milk. How does this work?
Well, we have a structure in place. The WEDA program, which is Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, had the tools in place to be able to provide backstops for or guarantees of farm loans and or agribusiness loans. What was needed was something a little bit larger and a little bit longer term in nature for successful operations to be able to think about long-term investments. Good example was a cheese operation that's been growing every year for the last 15 years substantially. They have sales opportunities. They want to expand the plant, employ more local folks in small rural community, buy more milk. And they were having trouble just securing a loan.
So that would help eat up some of the supply of milk here. Would these loans, though, potentially be used by dairy farmers to produce more milk in an already, I don't know if glutted is the fair word, but an already saturated market?
Some of the loans could be. I mean, these are particularly looking at loans for special purpose facilities. So, you know, if you go to a bank and say, I want to build a cheese plant or I want to build a milking parlor, those are expensive structures. They can't be used for anything except the purpose originally intended. And that means that, you know, their collateral value is lower than probably the cost of building them.
Is this something that that dairy farmer could use to, say, update equipment? They're working with older equipment. An investment in something now would make their operation more efficient and maybe cheaper.
It could, but again, these are all going to be scrutinized by banks first and foremost to see whether or not they believe that the loan is going to be successful. Would it be contributing to the profit of a business? If not, the loan wouldn't be made in the first place. This is simply asking the state to stand behind this as a guarantor of the loan, not actually lending the money.
And is this kind of a bottleneck for farmers right now, the lack of access to the kind of finance, the kind of loans that would help them do these things?
It can be. And so it can be that for farms and it can be that for dairy processors. So the entire supply chain has to work. You have to look at where's the bottleneck in all of that, because if farms are willing to produce milk but you haven't got plants that want to buy it, then you are stuck with low prices.
And then the other recommendation so far is investing in agricultural research and education through the UW system. There's a tradition going back a fair way of this kind of thing happening at UW. What kind of things are you looking for here?
Well, it does sound self-serving for me to be sitting here and talking about that, but honestly, I'm an ex officio member, non-voting, and this was people who actually are working day-to-day in the industry that that brought this up and want to see it done. What they'd like to see is a continued stream of research at the processing and at the farm level. They felt that that's much of what has supplied success to our dairy industry now, and it's a long-term investment. It's not a short-term thing. We've lost quite a lot in the way of positions at the university over many years, and they'd like to see some of that reinstated in a dairy hub.
And there were three campuses suggested, I think, Madison, River Falls. Was there one more?
Platteville,
yeah.
Yeah, those three are the campuses that have agricultural programs in place. And so, you know, we'd be looking at some of the investments sprinkled across those campuses.
Are there specific kinds of research that you're looking for on the task force?
Well, a continuation of and an expansion of some of the things that we do now, for instance. So innovation in new dairy products or processing technologies is one of the things you can always hope for. The last task force recommended that the state focus on specialty cheeses away from commodity cheddar, which was largely produced in the state. And looking back in hindsight, that was a very smart thing to do. We need to think about some of those kinds of things going forward. Same thing is true for new ideas, better management, innovation at the farm level as well.
Those are the recommendations so far. What are some of the other topic and issue areas that the task force is going to be looking at in the months to come?
Well, we have 9 committees that were formed that were an amalgamation of the 130 issues that the task force identified at their first meeting. They were aggregated into kind of thematic areas. So there were some things like regulatory certainty. So we have plenty of regulations in the agricultural industry, and people wanted to feel as though those regulations were being uniformly applied across the state. And that the goalpost didn't move, you know, when you were building towards some of the regulations that were in place. Rural communities, how do we ensure vitality of rural communities as we lose population there? That was one of the other committees looking at markets and prices and volatility. We have an education workforce one. Many of our farms and plants in rural communities are having a difficult time finding an adequate labor force. And so one of the committees is looking at that. Access to capital, and also thinking about the next generation. How do we transfer farms and businesses to another generation of folks?
Now, that rural community and rural economy piece of the puzzle, can you talk about the importance of Wisconsin's dairy industry and dairy processing industry for economic vitality in rural areas that really need it?
Well, the last time we took a look at the economic impact of dairy in the state, this is not just at the farm level, but through processing and input suppliers and all the rest of it, it was a value of about $43 billion annually to the state's income. And, you know, those dollars get spent in local communities and, you know, they support dentists and they support, grocery stores and a variety of other things. They leverage their way through communities. So you need a vital rural agriculture to be able to support a vital rural community.
We'll leave it there for now. I'm sure we'll check back in with you over the course of 2019. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
Mark Stevenson is the Director of Dairy Policy Analysis at UW-Madison and the Director of the Dairy Task Force. He was with us to talk about the group's new proposals aimed at loans for farmers and new research into the dairy industry.
Coming up, we'll find out why Americans could be doing a lot better when it comes to knowledge of state politics and government. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. Coming up, Governor-elect Tony Evers is appointing more people to posts in his cabinet. We'll find out who's joining Evers' team in just a bit.
But first, state government has a big impact on our lives. State lawmakers set policies on everything from health care to road funding and much more. But despite that, many Americans lacked an understanding of how state government works and who represents them. That's according to a new survey from Johns Hopkins University, which finds a state-sized gap in our knowledge of politics.
Fewer than 20% of survey respondents could name their state legislators, and a third were unable to name their governor. In addition, many respondents didn't know if their state had a one- or two-house legislature or if being a state lawmaker was a full-time job. And more than half of respondents didn't know whether their state had a constitution.
Eric Giordano joins us now to talk about the survey and some of the potential reasons behind its findings. He is an associate professor of political science at the UW-Stevens Point and director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Eric, I want to ask you right off the bat, were you surprised by the results of this survey?
Not really. I mean, I think we've seen surveys similar to this. Most have not focused on the state level. Most have focused on the national level. But, you know, we're probably all familiar with the surveys where most Americans could name the 5 members of the Simpsons family but couldn't name the 5 freedoms of the First Amendment. So, you know, we're kind of used to this lack of civics knowledge, unfortunately.
Why do you think Americans are lacking when it comes to knowledge about how state government works and also who represents them?
Well, I think there's a couple issues we could look at. I think number one, there's sort of a feeling, I think, that we as Americans have had for forever, I guess, since our inception, that, you know, if we don't really need to worry about something, if it's working, if it ain't broke, you know, don't fix it. There was an interesting quote from a famous political scientist, of course, famous to us political scientists, Morris Fiorina. He said this: voters typically have one comparatively hard bit of data. They know what life has been like during an incumbent's administration. So, you know, our data set as voters is pretty limited to what we experience and what we care most about. And most people don't, you know, care about the nitty-gritty of how government operates and what it does, unless it affects us directly, and then we suddenly care a lot.
Well, the survey looks specifically at state government, but if we drill down even further, speaking of when you said how it affects all of us, if we drill this down even further and looked at local government, like city or county government, do you think Americans would know even less?
I suspect they would. You know, we do have opportunities, more opportunities for service at the local level. So you're going to have a cadre of people who are willing to participate and who, but an even smaller amount who are willing to come to a town meetings, city councils, county board meetings. And frankly, you know, we know maybe a little bit about what's going on locally, so that matters. But, you know, unless it's something that affects us, our neighborhood, again, I don't think we look at the ins and outs of how budgets are put together and zoning issues and laws. And I think that a lot of that just goes really beyond us because we don't need to know those things most of the time.
Well, to expand on that, why is it important that we as Americans understand how our state government works and who represents us?
Right. So it's a great question. And the big concern really is about a lack of knowledge means that we are potentially open to manipulation. And I think there's evidence historically in many other countries as well as our own that, you know, you can have people who can come in absent information, accurate information, who can put out stories that just aren't true. I hate to use the word fake news, but, you know, we're in the era of fake news and fake news is real. And people can get excited when they hear things that may not be accurate or that may exaggerate certain things. And that can skew reality and skew what we understand as truth.
You were talking about one of the consequences being, you know, falling prey to fake news. But what are some of the other consequences of not understanding who represents us and how state government works?
Well, just to carry on that theme just a little bit further, it's a lot easier for special interests, for example, to come in on a specific issue and really spend a lot of money in advertising and around particular issues. And suddenly we are inundated with information, but it's information from a very particular point of view, and we don't really have enough information to counter that. And therefore, you know, we are susceptible to be manipulated that way. So that I just wanted to emphasize that point. I think in general, there's a lot of things that do affect us that we ought to be caring about, things as simple as whether the state or local elected officials get to make the rules on how things are done, everything from, like you said, transportation issues to budgeting to, you know, all sorts of different things, mining issues. And if we aren't aware of how government works and who is responsible, then we're going to have very little effectiveness in making change.
Eric Giordano joins us. He is an associate professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point and director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. And we're talking about why many Americans are lacking knowledge of how state government works and also what we can do about it. So, Eric, what do you see as the factors behind this lack of knowledge?
Well, one of the things that the author of the study points out, Benjamin Ginsberg from Johns Hopkins, is that we're lacking in media coverage of state and local affairs. And some would argue, especially, you know, out here where I'm living in Wausau, Wisconsin, and in other parts of outstate from Milwaukee and Madison, you know, we're facing news deserts. We're facing a situation where we aren't necessarily getting the news that we need in order to make informed civic choices. And I think that's a serious problem. I mean, I can turn on the news right now, and I can flip the channel to multiple cable channels, and I'll probably hear the same 3 to 5 stories repeated over and over after every hour, and yet I will not see anything on about local news except perhaps, you know, some sound bites in the early evening and early morning.
That is exactly one of the things that the Johns Hopkins researchers cited. It was the lack of media coverage of state affairs as one of the big reasons behind this. How can we change that?
Well, you know, I'm a WPR fan, so I would say more people need to listen to WPR. I think they actually went, you know, we've been working with the Wisconsin Humanities Council on a project up in Superior, and we were doing some focus groups there, and one of the news sources that they cited for state news was Wisconsin Public Radio. But outside of that, interestingly, they really found it was difficult to find information about what's going on in Madison around government and politics. And I don't think it's limited to Superior. There are many other places where we aren't really getting this information.
You know, I remember in school when I was young, learning a lot about how the federal government works, but not so much about your state government. Can you talk about the role that schools can play in civic classes? Are they going to be the ones moving forward to lead this charge?
Well, Darrell, you're pressing all my buttons. Of course, I am not going to lie. I fundamentally believe that schools have a potentially huge role here. And frankly, I would argue that, you know, we need to do much more around civic education. And yes, we do have some civics in 8th grade, 10th grade, but you know, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And most people have said that we need more. I think most people probably agree that we need more. At least that's my contention. I would love to see schools leading the charge here, but I think it really is going to take, you know, some significant effort. Now, we do have a state law that says that, you know, all graduating seniors, you know, from Wisconsin high schools have to have passed a 100-question civics test. However, that's not really focused so much on state politics. So again, we're sort of still lacking in that area.
There was a comment from Dave on Facebook who writes, not only do Americans not know how government works, many don't care. And that's really the scary part. And you were talking about that earlier. What do you make of that assessment?
Well, you know, I think it's troubling. I think, you know, as a citizen, you know, my personal belief is that we have a responsibility to vote, to know why we're voting, to know who we're voting for, and to understand at least on some basic level how government affects our lives. But the truth is, you know, we're living in a world where there's a lot of stresses, where people don't have all of their needs being met, and they're sort of living day to day. And then I think we're also distracting ourselves, you know, with a lot of media, you know, electronics, things that entertain us but aren't necessarily educating us.
And finally, what would be your recommendations going forward so that we could all get a little better about understanding state politics and government?
Well, I think there's nothing better. You mentioned education. I would love to see more experiential-based education where students aren't just, you know, memorizing the facts. I think that is important. I think we need to understand the Constitution. We need to understand state government and its branches and roles. But I would like to see students interacting with real legislators, with policymakers, with policy influencers, linking an experience of learning about government with talking with people who are in government. And the more that we can do that kind of education, both in and out of school, I think the better off we'll be.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Eric Giordano is an associate professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point and director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. He joined us today to talk about why so many Americans are lacking knowledge about how state government works and what we can do about it.
And there's still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Does this worry you, these survey results that show a lot of Americans don't know much about how their state and local governments work? What solutions do you see out there? What would you like to see change to get people informed and maybe more involved in politics and government? Does it worry you about the future of elective government, representative government in Wisconsin and elsewhere? Share your thoughts, maybe your stories as a civics teacher. You can do that at Ideas, the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Are you a big fan of something? A sports team, a musician maybe, an author, a comic book and or movie franchise?
Tomorrow at 4, we'll talk about the psychology of fans. And we want to hear your stories starting right now.
You can call the Ideas Network hotline. The number is 833-424-3327. That's 833-424-3327. Or if you like letters and numbers, it's 833-42-IDEAS. Darrell, you, I found it earlier today, took a big step as a fan at one point in your life.
Yes, I am. I'm a fan of all things Philadelphia sports. As you know, I'm from Philadelphia originally.
Right.
And I am a huge Philadelphia Eagles fan. And as you know, they are the defending Super Bowl champions. And
right.
when they won the Super Bowl, actually the week of the Super Bowl, I told a friend that if they won, I would finally do something that I would had been kind of waffling to do since I was 18 years old, and that was get a tattoo. They won, so I went and did it.
And you've got their logo tattooed on your arm.
On my left arm with my kids' names in the feathers.
Awesome. So, I mean, I think of myself as a fan of a lot of different things, but I'm kind of a dabbler, right? I'm not hardcore enough about anything to say get a tattoo or get a tattoo of anything. You took it to another level here.
I did. I took it to a whole nother level. But, there was a huge legion of fans who went out and got tattoos in Philadelphia after they won. So at least I didn't feel like the only one.
All right. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.